Here we go. Welcome back.
You survived. And for those of you who got to be in Fleming on Monday, you will notice that we have full illumination and the controls work.
Yes.
Okay. So, and if you missed it and want to know how they do those lights, the new machine is out in the foyer. If you just want to go look at the genie, it's really quite a contraption. Okay, no, we don't have the exams graded yet, but we've started thinking about the fact that we probably should. So we will. We do have the exam analyses from the first exam, and we'll give those back at the end of class today if you did that. About half of you did it, and they were quite well done. Vanessa?
Will there be another one after this exam?
Will there be another exam analysis exercise? Yes. And for those of you who didn't do the first one, you may do it on the second one. Those of you who did it on the first one, the exercise will be different. But we will post the second exam key next week, okay, after we grade them. Okay. Other questions? Oh my goodness, look at that. Speech. Yeah. Okay, this is unit 2.5. So, if you were expecting that we would start on personality and social development today, we're actually going to do that by implication because we're going to be talking about language today. I had shortened the second unit and shortened it one day too much and didn't have time to cover language development, but I think it's too important to leave out. So there are elements of language development that I want to cover today, and that will be the topic for today. But part of what we need to think about is what language does for us. And so we'll start there a little bit. I think all but a couple of the overheads today are on the web, and I will check that and make sure that the new material that I use today goes on the web tomorrow. Okay. And then on Monday, we will launch into the personality and social development unit directly. Just to give you a bit of a heads up, you probably have noticed that the third unit is just a couple of days longer, as in number of lectures. It will seem longer than that because it's dark. You know, you noticed when you came in the sun is setting, and when you leave it's going to be the middle of the night today. And that will get worse through the rest of the semester, so it's going to seem like it's real long. But the warning that I want to give you is that this unit has as much reading as units 1 and 2 combined. Okay. So there's more reading, more material to cover than each of the other units had. Okay. It's the way the book is set up. There's more material on personal and social development. The other stages in the other units, the chapters were the same length, but they were covered half in each unit for each stage. So just a heads up so you don't come up to the realization sometime in mid-December that you are way behind in reading. On the other hand, you have all that time during exam week after you finish all your other exams before this one, which is the last day. So you'll have all that time to catch up on your sleep and your reading at the same time. Right. Okay. Language. Language, so important for us. Let me start right there. Speech. Speech is not quite language, but it's important to language. But we study it differently, and we think about it differently. So let me talk about it briefly, because we can get that out of the way, and then we can talk about the essences of language and vocabulary and grammar. Speech is a term that refers to vocalization, how you make sounds. And speech is unique to human beings. Other species make sounds, and some of those sounds that we're not sure how to interpret yet. It may turn out that the dolphins have language. It may turn out that whales do. According to the paper this morning, mice sing. I haven't heard the recording yet, but I'm dubious. Why not? Birds do. Why not mice? We make sounds that are very complex, and creating sound, speaking, is a motor skill. It's a very complex motor skill. It's one that begins in the same way that all other motor skills do. You have a structure that is reflexive. And in the case of language, the structure is very complex. It has three, what shall we say, zones. And the first of those is the pressure apparatus. And that provides the air pressure that is necessary for speech. And that's produced by the diaphragm and the lungs. And so before you can speak, you have to learn to breathe. Infants do that pretty early on, or else. So they've got that part of it. The second part, the second zone, sometimes referred to as the resonance area or zone. Resonance is what makes the sound rich or very thin. And you create those differences by the pressure, the stress that you put on the larynx, the vocal folds in the larynx. What you do with the oral cavity, which can either be very closed or very open.
And what you do with the nasal cavity. The nasal cavity can be closed off and make your sound nasal.
Or you can leave it very open and not have a nasal quality. So the resonance chamber that you use in speech is that goes from the vocal folds, the larynx, up to the nose. And you learn to control all of those. The third zone we typically refer to as the articulatory zone, and that's the part that makes the specific consonants and vowels that, and clicks and other things that might be part of speech. And that part of your vocal apparatus includes the soft palate in the back of your throat, the tongue, which can be in many different locations and move in different ways, and the lips, which can be drawn very tightly together to make an M, or open, or pursed and pouted against each other if you want to make a P, or less if you want to make a B, which is a soft P. And P is plosive, and B is not so plosive, and M is not plosive at all. Okay? So you have all of this apparatus that requires several dozen sets of muscles from down here, around the diaphragm,
right on up through my nose,
which I can
shut with muscles,
or my tongue, which I can waggle, or put back in my throat if I want to go blah, blah, blah. And I learn eventually to put all those sounds, all those muscles together, several dozen sets of muscles, all of which have to be brought under motor control. Reflexively, infants make sound. It's just there. So when a baby is born and it decides it wants to breathe heavily and it's fairly stressed, it just opens that vocal apparatus and produces pressure and it goes, ah! And the whole system is wide open. High pressure, usually when it's making that kind of sound, the vocal cords are stressed, so they're tight, and that makes the pitch high. And then it opens the resonance chamber as much as it can, and sometimes sticks its tongue out and just creates a ah! Sound. And that's how babies cry. They just produce that sound. As they calm down, eventually they will do that reflex action with less stress. So with less stress, it comes out as ah!
Ah!
And it's fun to watch babies. Some of you have done this, who watch newborns and kids as they go through the first couple of months. They often startle themselves because all they're doing is wiggling their bodies, just like they do, just this undifferentiated global action, and they do it to their diaphragm and their vocal cords. I use vocal cords and vocal folds interchangeably. Okay. So sometimes I try to say them together so they come out as fords or colds. They're not really cords. That's the vocabulary has changed. They're not really cords. They're folds in the larynx. But we still call them cords. So the baby wiggling around is wiggling around with its breath, with its lungs, with its diaphragm, and occasionally gets the vocal folds in the right position to create a sound. And if you watch babies while they're moving everything, including the vocal apparatus, and they're sometimes producing sounds that are quite sudden, quite shrill, quite interesting, and they startle themselves. And they amuse the rest of us who love to watch babies. Gradually, babies bring the vocal apparatus under control. They figure out that if they focus on it, in the same way they can focus on closing and opening their hand, or waving their arm, or not waving their arm, they're making it intentional, they learn that they can intentionally produce sound. It doesn't have to be an accident. And once they begin to do that, then they start playing, exploring what they can do with the vocal apparatus. It's one of the wonderful times to just sit with a baby who's not paying any attention to you, who's figured out that sounds can be made, and they start practicing. Or in the middle of the night, they wake up. Some parents who use baby monitors get to listen. Now, there's the baby all through the first year playing with sound, just fiddling, improvising with this incredible apparatus, and gradually learning to produce sounds intentionally. Not just any sound, but specific sounds. And then they can start imitating. As they're learning to control the vocal apparatus, babies make all of the sounds that human beings make in any language. You read that in the text, and we went over that a little bit before. They are capable of producing and hearing and distinguishing every sound that infinite variety of combinations of positions and movements of the vocal apparatus can produce. Gradually, they learn to imitate what they're hearing and to imitate deliberately. So they create the game of you produce a sound, they work at producing a sound, and sound matching appears to be built into the brain. It's creating a familiar sound and then imitating it, matching it. So the game for parents and caregivers is to make sounds while the baby's paying attention to you and let the baby practice. And so you get reciprocal games of ma, 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 ma. As the kid gets more and more practiced, the sounds become closer in approximation to the sound that the adult is making. As the infant is beginning to do that imitation, it's also training the brain to hear the sounds that are spoken by people in its environment. And that means if you're in an environment where people are speaking English, you're beginning to focus on the sounds that are likely to occur in English. At the same time, you're ignoring, because you're not hearing, sounds that are not made in English. Doesn't mean you can't hear most of them, but you may lose your ability to discriminate some of them that are close together. So the brain is beginning to tune, it's adapting to the experience that the infant is having by, again, as it has in the past, in other areas that we've talked about, by focusing on the repeated experience and creating schemas, familiar patterns, in the auditory cortex for those particular sounds. And as it's doing that, it's gradually losing the potential for creating schemas for sounds that it doesn't hear. If a baby is hearing two or three different languages, then it will keep the broader array of sounds possible. It will develop schemas for all of those sounds as it's hearing them and as it's trying to match them. Going back to the overhead, these are familiar. What it's doing is differentiating sounds from the larger pattern of sound that it's hearing, and it's beginning to be able to integrate them, its production of them, into the articulate speech that we expect. And that's a process that takes actually several years. Babies get pretty good at it early on, but as you're all probably aware, a lot of two-year-olds will speak a great deal and you won't understand a great deal of what they say because their articulation is not clear enough, in part because of the limitations of their vocal apparatus. One of the problems for kids is that, I don't know if you know it, but in order to suck efficiently, to nurse efficiently, babies have a fatty pad in each cheek. It's called the cheek pad. And that cheek pad, which you can feel by just feel the thickness of the cheek by putting one finger in carefully and thumb or finger on the outside, and just feel how thick the cheek is. Yours is pretty thin. But for a newborn, it's quite thick. And that thickness in the cheek fills in the space. Remember, there aren't any teeth there. And it fills in the space so that the baby can create a nice seal and suck efficiently. As long as the cheek pads are in place, there are limits to what the baby can produce vocally. When there are no teeth, as you may know from people that you work with, or your grandparents, some of you, or your parents, some of them, without their teeth, there are some sounds that don't come out clearly. And babies also often have tongues that are fairly large, also, again, partly for sucking, relative to the size of the mouth, so they can't make as clear distinctions in their mouth. So there are articulation problems that are based on just the nature of the apparatus and the fact that it is still developing. As they get bigger, and as they have more practice, their articulation will get better. Some kids will still have problems until they're 6 or 7 putting some sounds together. And they'll have trouble with some sequences of sounds when they're trying to create a sentence. It's fairly typical for kids to stutter. It's fairly typical for kids to mispronounce words just simply on the basis of the fact that this is a motor skill and they're still learning it. Most typically what kids have difficulty with in articulation is combinations of three consonants. And one of my favorites is SCR, partly because my own kids had difficulty with it. We use that a lot. You know, kids are used to putting their money in escrow. Well, maybe they're not, but some of you know what an escrow fund is. If you've got an itch, you want to scratch it. And TCH is another combination that's difficult. And what happens is that kids can differentiate the sounds individually, but putting them together, integrating them into a sequence of sounds that is consistent, is difficult. So if you listen carefully, often kids will scratch an itch, and there's no C in there. Sometimes they'll scratch an itch, and we know what they mean, but there's no R in it. And one of the kids in the preschool was famous for scratching his itch. It didn't have an S in it. He could put any two of the letters together, but he couldn't get all three of them together. Another, if you're looking for difficulties, is the MPT sequence. As in, my glass is empty. Or prompt. The word prompt. If you listen carefully to how kids are pronouncing them, they're often not getting the T in there. Their glass is empty. You know, they want to get there promptly with no T in it. And that's a fun one, because when you put the LY on it, you've got four consonants now. And kids will mispronounce that for a long time. They can get the promptly without the T. They can get the promptly, substituting an N for the M there. Just figure out how many variations you can make of the incorrect sequence, and some kid will do it that way. But that's simply because they haven't had the opportunity to practice that, and for some kids they may not hear all of the sounds in sequence. So they may persist right on up into middle age mispronouncing particular sequences. And we try to sort those out for kids so that they can practice as early as possible making the sounds that are, particularly the words, the sounds of the words that are important in their lives clearly, so they can communicate clearly. Not being able to understand a child's language is a real problem. One of the things that language does for us is to allow us to share our understanding. That's probably why we've evolved it, so we can communicate across time and distance. And if you can't pronounce things clearly and people can't understand you, but they expect to be able to understand you, then you have a problem in the relationship. So communication suffers if articulation is not clear. Okay. The articulation, the vocalization starts with a cry. It's just open. It gradually gets defined so that it's more variable and gradually controlled. And then eventually the kid starts to produce coos. We call them that because typically there's a consonant, a closed sound, and an open sound. Sometimes kids will just ah and ew. But what they seem to like to work on is having the system closed and then making something happen. So the system is closed and they go la, na, da. All of those start with a closed apparatus, and then the pressure forces it open, makes the consonant, and attaches the vowel to it. As kids gain more and more control, they start to really babble. That's good training for being a teacher. Some of you have parents who babble a lot. You know, they just talk all the time. What kids do is practice the production of sounds and the variation, and they string things together. So they go ba ba da 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 ba 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 la da la 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 na 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 da 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 da, and put in all of those sounds. And then the next step is that they begin to show you, if they can hear, they begin to show you that they're paying attention to what you do. They have probably tried to imitate pretty early for most kids. So if you put your face right in theirs and make a sound, they will work to try to match that sound. Babbling they do on their own. They just do it because it's fun. And they do it so that at the first it's controlled repetition, or what we call reduplicated babbling. Actually, that overhead is wrong. The reduplicated does not necessarily mean that it's modulated. The reduplicated means that the sounds are made over and over again. My favorite son got to that stage in the middle of winter when we owned a Volkswagen Bug. And so he's a pretty intense kid. So we would be driving down the road and he would be engaging in his play at 90 decibels in a closed car, going over and over again. He could do that for hours. He still does that, except now he tends to make sense because he has vocabulary. The modulated babbling is different. That is the one that begins to reflect what the child is hearing. And that's the reduplicated babbling with added to it the intonation pattern. It's sometimes called intonated babbling. That makes a kid sound like she's trying to be human. And so the kid will go ba ba da da ma. Ga ga gla ga. Ba ba. Da 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 da. The kid will pick up the toy phone and go, hello. Or, oh. Depending on what she's heard. The modulated blabbling means that the kid is putting together the strings of sounds that make up the language the child is hearing. And that's when the production of speech begins to be differentiated, so that a child speaking in Vermont is going to have a particular pattern. A child who's learning Chinese is going to show a different pattern. And what's happening is, although the kids are not saying words yet, they're reproducing the streams of sound that they hear. They're getting that undifferentiated stream of sound that we call speech. And then that's probably what the kid hears. The adult is speaking, the kid's got the sounds, but hasn't yet broken speech into words. When the child starts to recognize and then to produce individual words, then you have the beginning of language. Okay. Enough on speech. Now we can turn to what language really is and think about why we're doing it. Up to this point, it's a fun thing. Language is a fun thing to do. It's very much like using your hands. It's useful. But there's no meaning in it as long as it's just the learning of the motor skills to produce the sounds that eventually will have meaning. But that is a big step to get to meaning. So, what is language? The definition I use that carries me fairly far is that language is a system of arbitrary symbols arranged in an orderly fashion to convey meaning. Symbols are words. The symbols of the language are the words. And that gets us into vocabulary. How many words do you know? And what makes something a word? How do you know something is a word? What does the word mean? Words arranged in an orderly fashion means you have rules. Grammar. Grammar is essential to language. If you don't know how the words go together, then you can't use the language. And why do you do it? To convey meaning. To share what you think or mean or feel, the ideas or concepts that are in your head, with another person. The language involves communication. And in this case, we have two people. They each have concepts or ideas or images in their heads, in their minds, and they use language to share their meaning, to convey it to each other. They emit utterances. They say things. What they say is their best attempt, usually, to translate the idea that they want to convey, the experience they've had, the feeling that they have, to convey that, to make it transmittable. Language has to be transmittable. So you take your concept, you translate it into words, you utter them, the other person hears them and retranslates them into his or her own understanding. The utterances are a translation of the ideas. They are not the ideas. That's why they are symbols. The words are not the concepts. The words refer to the idea or concept. So, if I want to tell you that I'm holding a piece of chalk in my hand, I can do that two ways. One is non-linguistically. I can do that without using language. I can go, Got it? He's holding a piece of chalk and he's waving it so you know he has it and you know he's holding it in his hand. Okay. It's non-linguistic conveyance of something. You don't have any idea why I'm doing that, but there it is. I'm doing it. When we do it linguistically, we have to have several symbols. One is a symbol for hand. And we use a word for this part of the body. Or five cards, if you're playing poker. And the word hand has no necessary connection to the meaning of the word hand. That's why it's a symbol. It's arbitrary. We just agree that that's what hand refers to. So if I'm carrying something in my hand, I talk about my hand, you understand what I'm referring to with that word, usually. not always. Chalk is a word, a symbol for that particular kind of object. It's long and this, in this case, white, and I'm not going to eat it today. I'm just going to refer to it with the word chalk. Language depends on our sharing the meanings of words, so that when you hear the word hand, you have a pretty good idea of what I'm referring to. And if I talk about chalk, you have a pretty good idea of what I'm referring to. And if I say I'm holding the chalk in my hand, in this setting, you have a pretty good idea what I mean. And you translate what I say into similar meaning in your head. Any of you gymnasts? I'm holding the chalk in my hand. What could I mean? Okay. What kind of chalk do you use? Yeah. Does it look like my chalk? No, your chalk is not in stick form. It's not small. It's probably a box or bag of powder. Powdered chalk. So when a gymnast says, I'm holding the chalk in my hand, she may be referring to a different concept. If we're on the cell phone talking, we may think that we're just great. I mean, she's standing in the gym, she's holding the chalk in her hand, I'm standing in the lecture hall, I'm holding the chalk in my hand. We're doing quite different things because the substance is different. It's an ambiguous word, or it's a word that has several different meanings. So it can refer to several different objects. If we were speaking French, anybody? What am I holding in my hand? What am I holding in my hand if you're speaking French? What is the symbol? Anybody know? That's too bad, because I don't either. I think it's some version of crayon. C-R-E-Y-O-N-N-E. Anybody know? Okay. I would use that word if I were speaking French. If I were speaking English and used that particular word, you might not have any idea of what I mean, except that you might try, because you know a word that's related. It's a derivative. It would be crayon, which is a trade name for a particular kind of waxy coloring stick, often made by the Crayola company, which is probably owned by somebody in France. But in English, crayon, or whatever the French word is for chalk, doesn't exist. We use chalk. Or chalk stick, sometimes. The notion of reference is essential to language. If your symbols are to be useful, they must have a reference. Where does the notion of reference come from? Reference is, at least in our primitive understanding, fairly limited to human beings. We're the animal that points. And babies learn to point very early on. Other species, particularly the primates, probably refer to things in a similar way that we do. Oh, since I turned the light on, you can't see that. Thank you. What babies do is they pay attention to our eyes. Very important. We are a visual animal. And eventually, sometime in the second half of the first year, kids begin to figure out that what their parents are looking at might be significant, especially if they're not looking at the child. It's a big step to go from something you are holding to something you are looking at. The babies learn in the second year, in the second half of the first year, to follow your gaze. We focus on other people's eyes and we pay attention to where they are looking. And that becomes a skill that most of us develop fairly well, so that if people are looking at something on the other side of the room, we can actually quite accurately triangulate what it is they're looking at. We look, but we're not in the same place. So we look back, we calculate the angles. We do all this without thinking about it very much. We calculate the angle of the person's eyes, what they might be looking at. We sometimes will put ourselves in the other person's position. So if you want to know what somebody is looking at, sometimes it's helpful to go look in the same direction and see what might be attracting their attention. I watched that happen a couple of weeks ago. I was outside and I noticed a father and a son, I think it was a parent rather than a teacher. I think my battery is dying, or that's a dead spot. The father and son were both looking up in the distance. From where I was standing, I couldn't see anything because the building between whatever they were looking at and me was in the way. But I could tell that they were looking at something beyond that building by looking at their gaze. But I had to go to where they were standing, and then I realized that they were watching workmen on a roof around the corner. They could see and I couldn't. So I had to put myself in their position. We can do that with visual gaze, and language is the medium in which we do it symbolically. So instead of sharing the information physically by looking where you're looking, I can use words to refer to that. And the intermediate step is that I look at what you are referring to because you're either looking at it or you're pointing to it, you're reaching for it, and I can then name it for you. For the child, the important step is being able to figure out how to refer to things by pointing at them. Kids will refer to things by running and getting them. They'll run into their room and get their favorite doll and bring it out and show it to you. They will point, they'll reach, and then later they'll point. It's a big step, so they can look at something. And if they really want it, and they want to draw your attention to it, they will reach for it, they'll point toward it, and they will vocalize. So they'll go, eh! Or they'll grunt, eh! You've got something they want, they reach for it, they point at it, yeah! Mine, yeah! I want it. Now they'll grab. The connection between vocalization and the thing grows out of that process. Then, once the kid has got that notion that it can refer to things or we can refer to things, then we just simply start building the vocabulary. We show things, we point to things, we label them. We provide the symbol. We give them the word. And at the time that kids are doing that, moving up into the second year, they are vocabulary sponges. Once you get the notion that what people say, the sounds that they make, can be used to refer to something, then kids have cracked the puzzle of language. And when they crack that puzzle, they want to know the word to everything. And often they develop a way of eliciting the symbol. So the 14, 15-month-old walks down the street pointing, going, "What's that? What's that? Zap! Zap! Zap!" And keeps doing it until you give the word each time. During that phase, kids appear to learn vocabulary words, the connection between the sound you make, the symbol that you create, and the referent with one trial learning. That's why we call them vocabulary sponges. They hear it once, they store it. It's a quick acting process that says the language center in the brain is activated, it's open, it's on high, and you'd better feed it. And during that period of time, when kids are grabbing those words with their reference, they'll be learning a dozen to 20 words a day. Some kids, 150 to 200 words a week, and they'll do that for months. So they very quickly know what a duck is, what a goose is, what the water is, what the pond is, what the feather is, what the foot is, what the web is, the duck food. And they exhaust you. Some of you have had that experience. You hang out with a kid in the second year who's really working on vocabulary into the third year, and you just spend all day giving reference. And sometimes kids want to know what the symbols are, the reference for things that you don't necessarily have labels for. But that's the vocabulary, learning the symbols. And words can refer to all the aspects of experience, anything that you can name. That's the ceiling. The lights are in the ceiling. The sprinklers are on the ceiling. That's the wall. That's the sound attenuating substance that they put up there. These are seats. That's a metal box. I don't know what it's for. That's an exit sign. That's a clock. That's a Julie. And by the time you're five, you probably have 5,000 to 10,000 words in your vocabulary that you use. You got them. There they are. And many of them were learned the first time the kid heard them. Then we refine the meanings, because each word refers to some particular aspect of experience. But what the kid is doing is getting the easy lessons first. What happens with vocabulary is that the kids are being told something when the something that's being referred to is being isolated. So part of what we do as parents and caregivers is we give differentiated segments of what would normally be a connected stream of speech. When you hear it as what would normally be a connected stream of speech, it's one long thing. It's undifferentiated to the new ear. What we do is break that up so that as we're showing kids things, we're isolating the thing and the word. And the kids are gradually differentiating, they're isolating the specific words out of that stream. And we do that. We help them do that by articulating more distinctly when we speak to children. We speak more slowly. We separate the words. And we tend to refer physically, sensory, motorily to something that we want to call their attention to. Okay. So if I want to give a kid the word for pointer, bring me my pointer. This is the pointer. I'm emphasizing it physically. I'm making sure that your attention is drawn to it, And I'm letting you know that that is the pointer. And fortunately, there's not another pointer in the room. Well, actually, there are. Language is incredibly fun. There is no stick or ski pole that I would normally use for pointing here, which is why I have my laser pointer. But each of you has a couple of pointers, right? Heather's sitting here saying, yeah. She's got her pointer. And the 2 or 3 year old is going to have his pointer too, or two of them. I got my pointers, so what the heck does that mean as a pointer? And that's one of the difficulties in semantics, figuring out specifically what we are referring to when we use a particular symbol. And that's not easy. When a child starts to speak, it uses one word. And it uses that one word to refer to or to symbolize what may be a very large experience. Birthday. Party. Present. We don't know what the kid is referring to. What happens is that we interpret the child's experience and speech together because we have shared the experience. If we know the child's context, we can expand the child's language so that it can gradually describe its experience in greater detail. So what happens is that the kid who's got this neat word up comes into the room and says, up. Great. There you are. Up. What does the kid mean when the kid says up? The kid is referring to some experience, trying to use language to convey that experience to you. Is it an intention? Is it a want? Is it I did something bad? Is it, we don't know. We have to figure out the context. So caregivers and adults do a lot of guessing. And in our guessing, we expand what the child has said. We don't go around saying, up. No, we say, do you want to go up? Do you mean you got up? The kid was taking a nap, got up, says, up. Oh, you're up. And gradually the kid will learn to say, you're up, when he gets up from his nap, because that's what he's heard. Does he mean that daddy went up? Does he mean that the sky is falling? We don't have much of an idea. So we spend a lot of time guessing, expanding the child's utterance, and making it more specific until we hit bingo. Oh, okay, that's what you wanted. And then when we figure out specifically what the child is trying to convey, then we try to give a complex utterance that will specify the words, the symbols that the child would use next time. And so we repeat, and we expand, and we emphasize. And as we expand and emphasize, we're giving the kids more precise reference for their meaning. And that's successful to the extent that we can figure out what they mean. Okay. Telegraphic speech, as kids begin to put two words together, they're saying instead of up, now it's daddy up, and that helps a lot. Because we know that daddy's asleep and the kid wants daddy to get up. So we can say, you want daddy to get up, go wake him up. Or if the kid says, I'm up, baby up, or go up. Putting that second word in there allows us to convey the meaning much more clearly. The more words we put in, the more specific we can make our meaning. Once we put two words together, we've started to use rules. Kids know that there's a difference between nouns and verbs. That seems to be built into the brain. Nouns are things, verbs are actions. And kids know that in their language, nouns and verbs have specific order. So if the kid comes out and says, "Daddy up," that's different than "up, Daddy." The kid will process those differently and create different meaning. If the child is learning German, it will very quickly learn that the verb always goes after the subject. And in fact, the important words, the important verbs in German go at the end of the sentence. You may put all kinds of stuff in between, but you have to wait to get the verb so you'll know what's really going on. English doesn't do that. We put the verb in early. Bring the baby up. So we put the verb at the beginning. One way to think about the rules of grammar is that they reflect the processing that the brain is doing of the meaning. And I'm going to reflect Chomsky here a little bit. Chomsky's version of linguistics just simply revolutionized our understanding of language. What Chomsky did, he's a linguist at MIT, what he did was look at languages of different types, and at that point, linguists, this was back in the 50s, 1950s, linguists were classifying languages into different families, and they were trying to figure out how they were similar and how they were different and how they evolved. And Chomsky began to realize that there was some similarity in among different languages, that there were some things that you could do in almost every language, not all, but in most. And he began to speculate about the relationship between the meaning that I have and the language that I use to try to convey that. And what he came up with was a realization that what we are doing in our language is transforming our meaning in specific ways. And he argues that the brain has evolved to use language. The human brain has evolved. It's one of our adaptations. Communicating symbolically is one of those neat steps that humans have taken that have helped us adapt and survive in our experience. So he argues, as does Gardner, that language is a specific function of the brain processing particular kinds of information in a particular pair or three of locations in the brain that allow the brain to put together input from the ears, output from the mouth, vocal apparatus, and ideas or meanings that are the reference for the specific sounds that we make. The brain somehow made that big step of being able to process the referent and then to use a linguistic process to refer to what we mean, or given words and experience to create a meaning from the words that we hear. So it's a two-way process. So in Chomsky's view, which I share, the human brain mind has evolved language as one of its skills. It's focused in a particular area. If you damage the areas where language is processed or produced, you mess up the language skills. Language takes major steps forward as the brain matures, particularly in those particular areas. And the brain has evolved to organize experience into particular patterns, and these are fundamental schemas. Objects and actions. Okay. Nouns and verbs. Single or plural? Is there one thing or is there more than one thing? What has already happened, what is currently happening, and what will happen? Past, present, and future. Before and after. Things that are real and things that could be but aren't, perhaps. Potential. These are just examples. There are hundreds of relationships or schemas or patterns that language represents. But the brain has the ability to produce these patterns from experience. It's the way we interpret our experience. Cause and effect, inside and outside. Negation, making something disappear, or saying no. Smaller, the same size, or bigger, that comparison. And what he argues is that we can, as we process our experience to fit into these schemas, our language gets connected to them. And again, the ones that I provided are only a few out of the hundreds of possible aspects of experience that we can refer to linguistically. All languages reflect some of those universal patterns. That's the way the brain works. Not all languages express all of the possibilities, so there are languages that can't refer to the potential, for example. It doesn't have any way to do that. There are languages that can't refer to the distant future. There are languages that can't refer to more than a few in number. And languages differ in how much attention they devote to being able to describe particular kinds of experience. Now, the classic example is the Aboriginal language in the Arctic that has some 30 or more words to refer to different kinds of snow. And here we have three or four. You all know about grapple. You use that term regularly, right? You know the difference between grapple, sleet, frozen rain, snow, dry snow, wet snow. We can begin to use modifiers. But in some languages, different kinds of snow are very important. Some are useful for making igloos and some are not. Some are treacherous for making avalanches. Some are not. So we develop language to refer to the aspects of experience that are important to us. Chomsky says, children's brains are designed to construct language from their experience, and they will do that even if they can't hear. Language does not have to be auditory, it does not have to be verbal. Children understand language before they can utter it. Communication is two-way. We convey our meaning to somebody else, and if they talk to us, we attempt to construct meaning from what they say, given our experience and our understanding of their symbols. Grammatical rules are the directions for changing our meaning. And each grammatical rule changes the essence of what you're trying to say in a specific way. Children seem to have the ability to abstract those rules from the experience they have and the language that they're hearing while they have it. We don't teach grammar until kids get to be up into upper elementary school, but kids know grammar. And grammar is generative. You can recognize correct grammar even if the content doesn't make any sense. You know that this is a classic sentence from somebody's description. Curious green ideas sleep curiously. You know that's a grammatically correct sentence. Doesn't mean anything. Well, it might. Wouldn't it be fun to figure out what a curious green idea is? What's a green idea? Do ideas sleep? Do they sleep curiously? I don't know. It's grammatically correct, but the vocabulary is very strange. Semantically, it doesn't make any sense. Even if you have the grammar down, you may not have the meaning. There's another classic example. Jill reported the shooting of the hunters. Okay, assume that Jill is a newspaper reporter. What did she write about? Something she heard? The shooting of the hunters, as opposed to the shooting of the army? The sound of their guns, is that the shooting of the hunters? Or did she report the game that they shot? Did they shoot very accurately and come home with 4 turkeys? Or 2 cows, or whatever it was they mistook for whatever they were doing? Or is she talking about wounding or murder of hunters? Did the hunters get shot? It's correct grammar. Jill reported the shooting of the hunters, but we don't know what the referent is here. And there are multiple possibilities. Once you acquire one of the grammatical rules, you can generate examples, and kids can do this. 3- and 4-year-olds do this. You show them a wug, and then show them 2 of them, and ask what you have, and they'll say they're 2 wugs. They know how to do that. I love to quag. Last night, what did I do? I actually slept, but I could have clagged. And tomorrow, what am I going to do? Tomorrow, I will clag. We know how to make that in the future and to make it specific. Every time you fill in a blank like that, you're applying a grammatical rule that you understand, you're familiar with, you believe in, that's useful for you, and you probably can't name it. But you can use the language. Okay, I'm going to stop there, and we're going to give back the writing exercises, if you did them. They will be down here in alphabetical order. Those are the exams. What happened to my big table? Whoops, those 2 aren't in alphabetical order. Julie? Okay, let me spread them out on the floor. Can I do that? I've got L's and beyond, and I'm going to... because my big table went away. They are alphabetical. These are L to Z. The ones on the table are A.
I was wondering, I got a call on them, and like I know that A is part
of. And if you don't get yours today, they'll be in the office tomorrow. No, not a problem at all. That's okay. No problem.
Mm-hmm.